Hey everybody, welcome back to Historians of the Movies podcast. This is your host and creator Jason Herbert, and every single week we are bringing you discussions about history and film and history and everything else in between. And this week we are bringing to you 1989's Glory, directed by Edward Zwick, starring Matthew Broderick and Denzel Washington and Cary Elwes and Morgan Freeman and a host of other amazing performers in this film. And this is a really important film. It is a film a lot of you asked for, and I wanted to do this one right for you. This was something that I took really to heart, and I went out and got not only four friends of mine, four people who I respect so much, but four absolute scholars of the Civil War, of Reconstruction, of memory, of the era, and how it relates to our lives today in 2024. This was something that I took really, really personally and seriously due to the weight of the material. And of course, I'm talking about Hillary Green and Holly Pinheiro and Chris Barr and Adam Dombey, four of my friends, four of your friends, hopefully after you listen to these folks, that are just phenomenal people who are doing work in this era that are helping to change how we think about the Civil War, how we think about the antebellum period, and how we think about memory and Reconstruction, all that today. So we recorded this pod a few weeks ago. I've had this sitting in our files waiting for you. I wanted to release this in February for obvious reasons because I think it's important. So I hope you enjoy this podcast. This is something that I think you really will. I learned a ton in this conversation. Guys, sitting down talking to these four folks, it's like playing catch with the 27 Yankees. These guys are amazing. And I think you're going to just come away with a whole new understanding, not only of this film or of the war, but really of the American experience. So sit back and relax, because Glory is next on Historians of the Movies podcast.
Hello, my friends. How are you guys?
Doing good.
You ready?
We're ready to roll.
Are we ready to roll? Because we've been talking now for half an hour before we ever actually hit record on this podcast. And I think I'm going to blame myself because for the very first time ever, I have a regiment of scholars on this podcast tonight. Holly's like, yeah. See what I did there? So I'm very excited.
Dad jokes alert.
Okay.
Dad joke.
This is a history and film podcast. So I need to talk about the history of the pod on this. We've been talking about doing a pod on Glory for like a year and a half. And Chris Barr kept putting me off and off and off. He's like, well, we could do it, but we have to get Hillary and Holly. We have to get Hillary and Holly. I'm like, what about Adam? And he said, who? And so we put this group together.
Already. We're like 30 seconds in. I'm getting ragged on.
Yes, absolutely. It's and you know what? It's only going to get worse as we go on. Although we were just talking.
We need a counter.
Oh, yeah. No, there's a spot. Like, we were just talking about demarking a moment for Adam Dombey.
I'll keep tallies.
For those of you at home keeping track, this is going to be the antidote of podcasts. It's just going to be an absolute bloodbath. Maybe seven of you out there understand what this means, right? It's a stalemate. It's not. It's just awful. So
I was going to say a lusty might be the better choice for a U.S.
Oh, case. You're bringing in the Florida stuff. Like the Florida man is like, oh, Florida was part of the war. Right.
It was. A lusty super important. I'm going to talk about a lusty.
Are you going to talk about the train?
No, I'm not going to talk about the train.
Oh, that's fine. Either way. All right. Let's talk about you guys. There are four of you here joining me tonight. Let's introduce each one of you. Talk about who you are, what you're doing here, and your beverage of choice, Coke or Pepsi. Chris Barr, who are you?
Hi, I'm Chris Barr. I'm the Chief of Interpretation at Reconstruction Era National Historical Park in Beaufort County, South Carolina. In a different time, it's sort of a different world, I guess. My quote unquote academic scholarship explored prisoners of war, especially African American prisoners of war, and how that shaped the politics of captivity, which was sort of my first introduction into sort of the 54th from a scholarship side of things. Because surprise, they're super important when it comes to prisoners of war, and the movie leaves all that out. I'm going to rant about that incoherently for about 45 minutes here in just a few minutes.
Oh, terrific!
But yeah, but here at the park at Reconstruction Era in Beaufort, my job is I sort of oversee the day-to-day operations of the Rangers, tours, all that kind of stuff, which given a big chunk of that movie takes place here in Beaufort, this is something we do talk about occasionally here at the park. However, since I am do have to give the official disclaimer that I am here on my own time, and my comments and statements tonight do not reflect the official positions of the United States government, the National Park Service, or Reconstruction Era National Historical Park, which is why I will not be able to give you a, despite the disclaimer, I'm not going to be able to give you an endorsement of the drink of my choice.
All right, Hillary Green, you're laughing.
So I'm Hillary Green. I am the James B. Duke Professor of Africana Studies at Davidson College. I am a native Bostonian. My dad's side of the family is from James Island, South Carolina. They were enslaved in some of the early battles of glory. I grew up witnessing the 54th Regiment Monument, and some of my Pennsylvania relatives served in the 54th directly. So for me, Glory is that film that allows me to talk about all my family history. And I'm currently writing a book about how everyday African-Americans remembered and commemorate the Civil War, in which Glory and the South Carolina experience of the late 80s, 1980s onward is a part of the story, because some of that is family history, not just individual history.
Holly?
Holly Pinheiro Jr., Assistant Professor of African American History at Furman University, author of The Family Civil War, Black Soldiers in the Fight for Racial Justice, which I'm very grateful won an award, but I'd say honestly the most rewarding part is that one of the descendants from the book has reached out to me. I was able to interview them for Muster. I've also met USCT descendants at Camp Nelson, and my hope is whenever I get the chance to do it with Chris and Seth, Beaufort, I'm hoping that there's those connections as well. And I also want to give a shout out. I actually lecture elements of Chris's work in my American history surveys. So I wanted to give that acknowledgement. But also, I have read elements of Dr. Green's new book. And to the audience, I tell you right now that it is going to change everything. And it better win all the awards. And I'm saying this to all those future awards members listening to this, because it is long overdue and much needed. And my next project, which is going to focus on all Black Pennsylvanians that fight to enlist and serve in Camp William Penn in Pennsylvania, I can't do that project without Hillary's book. That's how important her work is.
Yeah, I really appreciate Hillary's work, and also appreciate the fact that you just issued the first thread on HATM podcast history. So that was, really cool as well. Adam Vaffy.
First threat.
Hi, I'm Adam Dombey.
First in the hearts of Americans, first in the fists of our competition. So,
oh yeah, my drink of choice is bourbon.
See, I knew you had some Kentucky in you.
Yeah, I love a good drink.
All right, should I introduce myself? I'm Adam Dombey. I'm the an associate professor of history at Auburn University, where I'm one of our Civil War historians. And I'm the author of The False Cause, Fraud, Fabrication, and White Supremacy in Confederate Memory, which came out in 2020. And then I'm currently working on a book on African-American sailors during the Civil War. And I also have read some of Dr. Green's forthcoming book. And I would reiterate, Holly's not going to be alone. Someone's going to got I got his back when we make those threats,
We're all cowering in fear now that Adam joined the fray. Go on. Yes, sir. Check.
just to be clear, I'm kidding. I do not actually threaten anyone.
Yeah, I'm a lover. I don't really threaten. It's just small.
I do feel that I needed to, in the spirit of joining you four amazing scholars, I wanted to go ahead and also dress up for the part in honor of the Civil War. I'm actually wearing a token of my appreciation for the Civil War right now. Wearing this shirt. For those of you not watching, this says Yankees baseball, and
you could at least go with the Columbus Blue Jackets, man. Like, at least, like, that's kind of cool.
I am what people refer to, Chris, as a winner. So I
not anytime recently, man.
See, this is perfect, because I want to actually bring up the point you just made to the opening of Glory, because I have one of my biggest problems. No one ever talks about with that film.
See, there we go. All right, you guys. All right, let's jump in. Let's jump in, because we actually have a lot to talk about. When we talk about the history of this film, actually the history of the war, I don't think anybody here is going to contest the idea that in 2023, the war still remains relevant in the lives of so many Americans and really well beyond the United States. And this is, when we talk about the history of the war, when we talk about films about the war, this is arguably the most important film that, and for different reasons, there are a couple others that come to mind. Gone with the Wind comes to mind, and Birth of a Nation also comes to mind, but for different reasons. But for when we talk about recent films coming out about the war, this has got to be maybe the single most important film. And I want to talk first and foremost about why it is. So if you guys want to jump in, let's talk about Glory and why this movie. Why are we here talking about this specific movie tonight?
So I'll kind of chime in first, and I don't know when this is going to come out, but as I was sort of prepping up for this last night, the news broke about Andre Brouwer. So I feel like I can't talk about Glory tonight without acknowledging Thomas, man. I'll see you in the fort, man. It's like everything I thought I was going to think about this, like, completely just got upended last night a little bit. But not to start off on too heavy of a note here, but
not a heavy note about the Civil War. We'd hate to have that happen.
No, but it's an important recognition.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think that part of the reason this movie is so important within sort of the bigger picture of the Civil War world with the general public, right? Because I'm not an academic, right? I'm somebody who works, I work with a lot of reenactors. I work with sort of the Civil War public. I think a big reason why this movie is so important is it was sort of the first time that for most people in the general public that the narrative began to shift a little bit. It was the first time that most people in the general public saw that, wait a second, Black people participated in this war? Like, our picture of all of this was always just sort of rows and rows and rows of, you know, white guys lined up shooting at each other, brother against brother kind of stuff. And suddenly this movie made a whole bunch of people kind of stop, turn, and go, wait, what? And then sort of piggybacking right behind that, I forget which one actually came first. Of course, Ken Burns' Civil War talks quite a bit about slavery as well. I think those two things together sort of set a new generation of scholarship and public awareness in sort of a different track. For better or worse, mostly for better, I think.
And for me, as a native Bostonian who vacationed every summer in the Charleston Low Country, because that's where my dad's family's from, James Island, Johns Island, Wamala Island, I knew about Glory, the 54th. I grew up with that. What made Glory matter happened not just when it came out in 89, was 2 years earlier when two random white relic hunters. There's no other way to describe it. They had a metal detector, and they just went out to a field and stumbled across a cemetery that was of the 55th Regiment. They didn't know that was the 55th. They thought it was the 54th. I grew up every summer seeing this, and I was just like, oh, wait, my family history is real? They're not telling me lies about Fort Wagner. They're not telling me lies about Battle of Solid Gree, Battle of James Island, because this is family history for me. And to see Glory and to see Boston as a Bostonian and someone from Massachusetts who grew up watching the freeze and just like, those are Black people. Like, I don't care about Robert Shaw. These are Black people. This is a Black Civil War. My family history was on the screen. Hands down, is one of the best transformative experiences I've ever witnessed, and seeing it in real time. But also that fear, are people going to deny this truth? Are they going to deny these stories? And more importantly, it was a Black film. These are Black actors. These are talented Black actors. This is Denzel Washington's like second film. Andrew brought the whole
Academy Award,
the whole cast. This is like a Black film about the Civil War. And it's talking about the 54th, even though there's other regiments, but you're talking about the regiment. And it's a Hollywood blockbuster film that got people to listen to my family's history, to listen to why I was a Civil War historian, because everyone thought I was crazy because I was a Civil War buff because of family history. And I was like, you're a Black woman. Why are you doing the Civil War? I'm like, because these are heroes. It was a hero film. That transformed everything. And so for me, seeing that, this was the film we always show in middle school and in high school. We saw this every single year. And knowing those communities that were a part of it who were never named. And then since Hollywood has yet to match this film, this is the film that matters the most because Hollywood has yet to duplicate this. They have never made a Black film of this nature ever again. And this film is like exemplar. I love this film because of that. It has problems, but the fact this was a Black film at a Black time that got people to start to think, oh, the Civil War wasn't just a white man's war. Transformative.
Yeah, I'll echo points. I mean, there's a lot of things I love about this film. There's a lot of things I hate, and I'll talk about them. One of them is the minimization of Black women in this whole context, particularly at Reedville. And we'll talk about that later, I'm sure. To echo Hillary's point, like, yeah, and I've lived all across the world. I went to 6 different elementary schools, right, just for context, across the U.S. And every school I went to, that film was shown. Right. And so like that's saying something, whether it was Virginia, Pennsylvania, Florida, New York, that was one of the films that was shown for social studies along with Schindler's List. And like there was a couple others that was like, you know, in that for me, and I'm not even going to say it as an academic, I'm going to just say it as a Black person, like to see someone on the screen that is being shown in a positive light, not as victims, as people who saved the United States of America, as people who just helped to end slavery, like that, that's what gets me, right? Is like the breadth of what they did that goes beyond the slavery story. And yes, there were enslaved men in that film, but they're not being portrayed in a way that echoes what every other popular culture, and I really mean white popular culture, depiction of the Civil War was. And I mean, it's an empowering film. I hate that it's that, to what Hillary said, I hate that there hasn't been anything close to that level. I had hoped Emancipation would, but you know, what happened before that release that pretty much effed that all up, possibly. But it's my hope is that Glory will inspire someone else. There's no reason that there can't be another, right? There's so many streaming services, damn it. Why can't there be a miniseries or something, right? Because that's my goal, right? Like I'm trying to get my book or some. I don't care whose book. Like, there's so many great works out there. And you know, I love Denzel. Rest in peace, Andrew. I love all them. Cary Elwes does not get enough props for his role in that film. Like, we talk about Shaw, whatever. Cary Elwes killed it, like, in my opinion. But it's just like, there needs to be more. Because the problem for me is becomes all you need to do is watch Glory, and that's your catch-all to understand Black military service. When there are Black experiences, there's not a singular. Right. And that's my frustration with that film, even though I love it. I love it.
Adam?
I mean, I can repeat what they've all said, but they're right. And I mean, I would just pick up where Holly was saying about there's other stories. There's tons of stories. There's and they can go into Reconstruction. There's a sequel that still needs to be made. What happens? You know, you see in the film all these people getting freed, right? They're coming through and it's a Jubilee has arrived and there's, you know.
Oh, we're going to talk about that in a minute.
Yeah. And where's the Reconstruction sequel to me is the question is I see you got to do an HBO epic miniseries with like massive cast where you got like Robert Smalls, Harriet Tubman, Shaw could get in there too, I guess. And they'll be all in the low country during the Civil War, and then what happens afterwards to the people they're interacting with? You got multiple episodes. I mean, I just, you know, maybe multiple seasons.
Once we get HATM film production going, you give me like another year or two. y'all laugh, but this is where we're going. I am pinpointing.
Like, let's roll.
We are building HATM into something bigger, and I swear to you, that is on the horizon. That is something that we absolutely want.
And that is not a threat. That's a promise.
You goddamn right it's a threat. I'm telling you, we're coming for blood on this one. Because here's the reality. So many of these stories need to be told. And they need to be told by people who have vested interest in the storytelling, right? And this is a lovingly told story by, of all people, you know, you've got a white Jewish young white Jewish director who was directing this, who had said during time he didn't know if the cast was going to accept the fact that he was doing this, but actually found that they were very supportive of the work because of how he was handling it. You know, this pod, I really want to do a deep dive into the conflict itself, but I feel like before we start talking about the war and then the film, there's a bit of terminology that I think even for me at times that I wrestle with. This is, the Civil War is not my specialty, but it is for you guys. So I want to talk a little bit about terminology of first and foremost about the war. When we talk about the Civil War, is it the North versus the South? Are we talking about the Union, the Confederacy? What terms should we really be using now in 2023?
When visitors walk in the door and use the word North versus South, I always kind of chuckle and say, look, you know, that would be a surprise to all the South Carolinians down here who joined the United States Army here and marched through these streets. I mean, there's Tennessee, I think there's 50,000 Southerners that fought for the Union armies. Yes, I avoid North versus South. Now, I mean, you know, if people want to use Union versus United States, I mean, to me, I like United States, but also get for, you know, just sort of semantics. Like a lot of people are just comfortable with Union. So like I'd use those kind of interchangeably. But yeah, it's not a war of North and South. This is not a war about where you live. A lot of times where you live can help predict that depending on your race. Like if you're a white Southerner, okay, chances are you're probably, if not outright supporting the Confederacy, you're at least okay with it.
I was going to say, for me, one of the distinctions is when you look at black soldiers, and especially the 54th, they're not Northern or Southern. They're both. It is a national fight. That is a national regiment. I prefer federal because they're not really citizens of the nation. And when we put North, South, Mason, and I have family who are literally on the Mason-Dixon line. I pass that line every single summer I visit family. Like, it didn't matter if you're a Virginian who ran away and joined the Massachusetts or Pennsylvanians and Ohioans. They're not Massachusetts residents. They're fighting for the U.S. Army because they couldn't do because of racism. They couldn't join a white regiment. So they are U.S. colored troops. So for me, I will use Union at times, but I don't like that either because I'm like, is it really Union or is it federal troops? Where is that allegiance? Who's given that ties? But also too, to talk about the nationalities and that these regiments were also national, especially when you talk about the black military experience and how black soldiers are enlisted. They are enlisted in U.S., not a state, not anything else, because racism still matters. And so, but I refuse to also adopt a lost cause language. When we talk about North-South, I will use Confederate because I'm like, that's okay. But Union, I'm like, really? Are they Union? Is this this dichotomy or is this federal? So I always try to, I will use federal over anything else, but Union will slip in because some documents you can't get away around. But for black soldiers, they are in USCT, USCI, USCCAV, and very rarely are they in a state regiment. And once you have that distinction, that's what I just have to go with the federal at that point.
But I think it's worth noting that the 54th is not one of those federal units. So it's this weird thing, like, you know, when you're talking about glory, you actually are. Like, oh. Whereas, yeah, but the naming thing is a really interesting thing when talking with the public, especially because what people grew up with. Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Holly.
No, I was going to say, I'd also actually add, and I'm thinking of Richard M. Reed's book on Afro-Canadians in Blue. Like, there were many black people. The Pan-African experience, you can actually see playing out in various USCT regiments, right? So having done master's work on New York and the first three Pennsylvania USCT regiments, I can tell you right now that there were black men from Germany, Peru, multiple spots, like Canada, like they're from all over the world and they come here. So I think that's something that as scholars, and I know there are, I've seen a few that are doing this. We need to acknowledge that black people come from all over, which I think actually is highlighting how inspiring this became for the Pan-African experience of liberating people who have maybe no actual ties to the U.S., but make the journeys to come to fight and sacrifice their lives to end slavery, to hopefully create a racially egalitarian society. You know, so I think that that's also important, is recognizing that the designation needs to be acknowledged of, like, people aren't just from the U.S., right, that are doing this. And that's why I always try to be careful when I'm talking about using black versus African-American, right, because my designation of African-American is someone born in the United States or its territories. When I'm using black, at least in this context, it's somewhat wherever. Right. But acknowledging that they are a person of African descent. So that way that's something I'm also trying to tease out with my students more, is there weren't just African Americans fighting in this war.
And that's where I go with the 54. I'm sorry, Adam, but because everyone says they're from Massachusetts, they're not. And I'm from Massachusetts. Like, no, they are all over the place. So they see themselves as Black Americans, colored Americans, but they're not seeing themselves as state lines either. So I think if our terminology, it's all of it in there. So if we do Black and diaspora, I'm more on board with that. But yeah. But the lost cause language and how we frame the war is huge. And for me, North, South, Union versus Confederate, that brings up why Glory is the only film that we have on Black experience and realistic things. I'm sorry, Adam.
Do I get to weigh in at all?
Go ahead.
Okay, we can move on. It's fine. I mean, I got things to say, but I don't need to say them.
We're waiting.
Okay. Well, I was going to pick up on Holly's point, actually, about Pan-African experience and point out that especially when you start looking at the Navy, you actually have even more of this going on because these are sailors who they were sailing all over the world and they end up in, you know, Boston and they're like, hey, they can enlist and they join up. And so you have people from all over the place joining. But I want to go back to this language thing for a second. There's 100,000 white Southerners who fight for the U.S. military. And I say U.S. military for a reason. I'm going to come back to that in a second. That's larger than the Army of Northern Virginia at its largest. When you think about that, that is a massive transfer of white manpower. And I'm just talking the white Southerners. And then you have around 180,000 USCT troops. About 80% of them, at least, are from Southern states, and border states, if I'm remembering correctly, that are joining up. I mean, that is, you're now talking folks from the South, you're looking somewhere over 200,000. You're well over, I mean, 10% of the U.S. Army is African American by the end of the war. I mean, this is a massive contribution to the war effort that gets overlooked. Now, I want to go back to this question about, you know, North and South, though, is that, and the best statement I think I ever saw about this came from Vernon Burton. And he said in a conference I was at one time, after a very angry white man got up and said, what people don't understand is that, they imposed on us, and he was going on and on and on. And Vernon just said, look, South Carolinians didn't lose the Civil War. The state of South Carolina may have, but the vast majority of South Carolinians supported the Union because the vast majority of South Carolinians in 1860 are enslaved, right? And so it is a
60%,
I would argue, yep, for the South or for Southerners in many ways to see the end of slavery. And so, yeah, I don't use the term South when I'm talking about Confederate. Now, I will use, when we're talking about the issue of Union versus U.S. Army, I think the key moment here for me as a writer is you got to alternate language. So I understand why people, and otherwise it gets, can get very clunky at times. But if you're talking about casualties, that's when I always make sure to use U.S. Army, because I don't want folks to forget that when we're talking about Confederates taking up arms and fighting, who are they shooting at? They're not shooting at the North. They're shooting at the U.S. Army. And that's treason. That's the legal definition of treason per the Constitution. Constitution only defines very few crimes, but treason is one of them. And taking up arms against the U.S. Army is the literal definition per the Constitution of the United States. So,
wait, I would say recent historical events have shown that treason is a fluid term, though.
Well, I'm not touching that one. But I would just say that. So I think that the use of the U.S. military is a really important one as we remind folks, as we sort of undo what the Lost Cause did, which was to turn Confederates into American casualties. Right. This is the thing. You always hear people say more Americans die in the Civil War than in all other wars combined or something like that. Or almost, I think there's, you got to cut the line at some point. But here's the thing. That only works because you're counting both sides. You don't do that in any other conflict. You don't do that in Vietnam, where you're not counting how many Vietnamese were killed. You're counting how many Confederates were killed. That's the enemy. You don't even do that with loyalist deaths during the American Revolution in that numbers, right? There are people born in the what it becomes the United States during the colonial period who joined the British Army. We don't count them as casualties, though. So somehow we rewrote, and I kind of wrote a book on how they did that.
What's it called again? What's the title?
They rewrote history, essentially, so that they were actually fighting for the United States somehow. Which is an amazing, amazing mental gymnastics to do.
I want to get into the war where we're at. The film opens up just
before Jason's realizing we're not actually going to talk about this.
Oh, we're going to talk about listen, this pod, if you were listening to this pod, you know we will often not talk about this movie, the movie for the first hour.
I'm aware. The pod can't last longer than the movie, man. Like, just.
We've had several instances where it does, and this might.
I know that it has.
Don't test him, Chris.
As a marathon runner, I appreciate the three-hour ones because they give me something to listen to on my long runs.
Yeah, well, our producer Fletcher,
I don't want to be a participant in that.
I would be all for it.
So, all right. Well, this is awesome because I want to go deep into this film. And you guys are really laying out the groundwork and the importance not only of why this film is important, but also the terminology and why and how we understand this war. Because so much of our understanding about the world around us is rooted in language. And that's the reason why I wanted to ask you specifically about how we consider the war, but also how we consider the people involved in the war, people who were participating in the war. And now I want to get to the war itself because I don't expect everybody to come to this film. And maybe a lot of people who are listening to this podcast might be coming to this film for the very first time and might only have a very passive understanding. Or if you're from outside the United States, maybe you've heard of Gettysburg or you've heard a few other things, but you might not know about Antietam or why black troops become necessary in the war for the federal government, right? So let's talk a little bit about the war itself and how we get up. The film opens up right on the eve of Antietam. Can we talk about the war itself and where we are right when this movie starts off?
Chris,
right,
is excited.
I'm about to jump to the screen here because this is one of my things. Like when this movie begins, right? So there's Antietam, you know, which is September of 1862, September 17th, incidentally, the anniversary of the Constitution. When that is beginning, and you see all this stuff, and they begin to present Captain Shaw with this whole idea of black soldiers. Black men have already been under arms in combat on the coast of South Carolina for like 6 months. All right, hold up. I can't do math. Maybe not 6 months. I'm a historian. I can't add. But like in the spring of 1862, or really in the fall of 1861, U.S. Army and the U.S. Navy captured the Sea Islands here around Beaufort, which is going to become part of the set for this movie. But almost immediately as part of this so-called Port Royal experiment, some of the early military officials that got here are abolitionists. I mean, you're looking at folks like David Hunter, who in the spring of 1862 are sort of not completely without permission, but they're sort of under the table a little bit, recruiting black guys from around the plantations because the white plantation owners abandoned Beaufort County. So there are black men wearing the uniform of the United States with that eagle in their button, bullets in their pocket. You knew somebody was going to make that reference here tonight. The musket on their shoulder, engaged in action against either Confederate regular or irregular forces as early as the summer of 1862. So like before Shaw is ever even like they're still poking around up on the outskirts of Richmond. And there's black guys here on the coast of South Carolina engaged in combat, fighting for not only their own freedom, but the freedom of their fellow countrymen. And I think that's a really important context to make, because I think a lot of times the way the movie makes people think about the war is, well, okay, here's Antietam. Oh, Lincoln has this great idea for emancipation now. Now we'll recruit black soldiers. And then Governor Andrews and somehow another, like the 80-year-old version of Frederick Douglass, as opposed to the actual wartime version of Frederick Douglass, walks in and says, Antietam was a terrible day, son. And here's this idea for black soldiers. It's already been going on for several months. And I'll start name dropping guys, and I'm trying not to get revved up here. So,
but honestly, the other thing about Antietam, which I don't, this is one of my things. So my mother's side of the family is from the other side of Gettysburg. Antietam is the first invasion that the Franklin County people talk about. Like, black people are hiding because they hear the sounds of war. They are literally going into the mountains. They're going into the spaces for the Underground Railroad. They're trying to evade capture. And Jeb Stuart, after Antietam in October of 1862, will actually come into Mercersburg, Pennsylvania, and seize people that then have to be bartered for their freedom because also Confederate policy is there. So Black men and communities learn, oh, wait, we can't defend ourselves. We need to start fleeing and protecting ourselves because we can't even trust the U.S. government in Pennsylvania to defend our freedom if Confederate troops come in. We can't pull up a gun legitimately if we get taken. Hopefully a white minister, usually a Lutheran, will actually defend us and get out.
Shout out to the Lutherans today.
And this, but that's the first invasion. When people talk about the border, they talk about invasions. That's our first one. And I'm like, so thinking about the people and the trauma and civilian trauma that's going on in the county side around the Pennsylvania-Maryland line. This is, and then also the helplessness of Black men unable to register because they try to defend the states and they can't. Governor Curtin saying, hell no, 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 no. You're not a citizen. Go home. But when they're about to march on Harrisburg next year in 63, send us troops now because we're about to be taken. So that when we talk about the war and also the civilian side of this, not just the battle, but this is a civilian attack too. Maryland's not in the war, but these civilians are definitely a part of the war again. And we talk about who is a legitimate combatant, who's not. And Black people are not legitimate combatants. And this is where talking about not only Black soldiers who are serving in South Carolina, but Black men who want to just defend their home, can't defend their home, and are forced to flee. And if this is the draw to get them to enlist, this isn't the draw to get them to enlist. This is the we weren't allowed to protect ourselves thing. So all of that comes into play.
So I'm just going to first say for the audience, Hillary, Dr. Green is dropping some gems from her forthcoming book just to highlight like some very important points. And I want to echo that because even looking at New York State, New York City more specifically, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Black people and some white abolitionists were petitioning to serve and train as early as when the war first started. And in New York City, they were forcefully denied the opportunity. So I think I'm saying this more to the public, is to acknowledge that Black people, and not just men, Black people had been fighting and demanding inclusion in this war long before the scene's depiction where Frederick Douglass is talking about that moment. Because I think it is frustrating to dismiss the, as Hillary points out, the battle lines. Black people knew what this war was about. They knew when John Brown died what this war was about. Very clear. They knew with the Compromise of 1850 and the Fugitive Slave Act, as I wrote in my book, they were at war for their survival long before they put on those uniforms. And if we acknowledge that the federal government, including free state politicians, supported a basically demands and holding, as one of my students wrote in her term paper, holds the United States hostage with slavery at the center. These people were fighting long before they put on the uniform. But I also wanted to, before I forget, make a point, and maybe I hope I'm remembering it right. Glory opens up with actually some language that I find super weird, is they actually use rhetoric that the Daughters of the Confederacy use when they're
war between the states.
Yeah, and I was like, how come nobody ever mentions that? And if no one does, I plan to write a blog post from Muster to unpack that, because to me it's like, how odd is it, given everything we've said about the importance of this film, that the UDC found their effing way into this film? And like that part just really, really pisses me.
I can explain that. And that's due to, you know who was a consultant on this film? Shelby fucking Foote.
Let's save that scumbag for later. But
yeah.
But I also want to acknowledge too, well, so I also want to at least point out what Hillary was saying is like, one thing, and as much as I love Glory and all the military service, the ableism that is inherent in the enlistment rhetoric in the military experience, and even as it relates to the enlistment processes and trainings, right? Like that is a part that a lot of people, including myself, have not given enough attention to, which I hope to uncover more, because I'll tell you right now, there were many people who wanted to enlist, even once it was approved, that were not able to do so. And what that meant when Frederick Douglass is saying, and others like Anna Dickinson, Lucretia Mott, whom I love, and others are talking about the importance of enlisting, and you're not a man unless you basically die for a country that legalized slavery. What about those who have physical or emotional or psychological disabilities? that are now being told you're not a man, right? Because you can't live up to that standard, a standard to protect a nation that doesn't even see you as a human being, right? Like, and that's the part that like I really struggle with in the rhetoric, and I love the film.
Can I add for Chris's point too? One of the things that, because I have family in South Carolina, you're only a man if you're from a northern state, because the South Carolina side, they're not men. That's a whole other thing. Like, where's man?
No, I mean, like, and I will just throw out, like, when I, in terms of the context, I also think for me, for those who are visual learners like myself, I would encourage the audience to actually watch Gangs of New York. It's a great film. There's a lot wrong with that film, but there's a lot that it gets right, in my opinion. Particularly
the podcast on it's great.
The New York City draft riot scene. Ignore like Leo's part, like that never happened, but the depiction of the violence, they were targeting Black people. First, it was Republicans, but primarily Black people. And I will tell you right now that 7 months after that moment, Black soldiers of the United States, the USCT 20th, marched down those streets. That was intentional. Why the hell nobody has done a film on the 20th is beyond me, because everyone talks about the New York City draft riot and Black soldiers marching down those same streets. But nobody wants to do a film on them, because I think highlighting the anti-Blackness was normal in the North, in a place like New York City, would actually highlight how we need to stop looking at the northern states as these liberal oasis places when they were hell.
So a few minutes ago, Holly, you referenced, you know, John Brown, and then Hillary was talking about, you know, these Black men are already fighting. You know, are they not men? And I said I wasn't going to start name dropping soldiers from the first South Carolina tonight, but I'm about to. One of the guys, Adam's like, oh, here we go.
I know who's coming too.
No, you don't. You don't know who's coming. There was a guy named John Brown who lived here on the coast, Gullah Geechee man. And he's one of those really early people out in the spring of 1862. That the U.S. Army, it's a sergeant named Charles Trowbridge, who later is going to become a company commander. Is basically kind of funneling weapons to wage guerrilla warfare against sort of Confederate positions all up and down the islands. And there's a small engagement on St. Simon's Island where these guys, and I forget if it's July or August of 1862, where John Brown is killed. And his dad, who's like 65, 70 years old, decides when they formally start recruiting into the regiment. His name is York Brown. He decides that he wants to join in memory of his son, John. And everybody knows John in the regiment. And so when the 1st South Carolina Volunteers is marching up and down the street that is not 200 yards from where I'm sitting, that street's going to later become a scene in the movie Glory. We'll talk about that at some point, I'm sure. But when they would sing John Brown's Body, they're singing it for their John Brown.
You realize you just like, that's actually like, that's amazing that like actually John Brown's plan was a success, just not the John Brown illuminate. But also, like, why don't we have anything on Susie King Taylor? I love Susie King Taylor.
I'm working.
Why isn't there a damn film on her?
I'm working on it. Well, I'm not working on a film. I don't have that kind of pull. But I mean, not that kind
of
pull. But
get your stuff together, Chris.
I'm working on it.
I would. I would just, you know, if you're talking also sort of thinking about this more larger about these early recruits, right? That are pre Emancipation Proclamation. There's almost always overlooked is the fact that the U.S. Navy has Black sailors before the war begins. They've
had them for years. Yeah.
They've had them for years. And they're not eligible to grab people with the draft. And they're like desperate for manpower. And they basically start enlisting actively what are called contraband, right? Runaway, enslaved people who make it to the lines because they need the labor. They need someone on these boats to be able to do the work that they need done as they massively try to expand the Navy. And so African Americans are on these boats and they're bringing intel, they're bringing food, they're bringing knowledge of the terrain around them and serving as guides. I mean, where's the Robert Smalls movie, right? I'm still waiting for that biopic to be made. And, you know, he's around, he's hanging out in that area at the same, right? He's running into the 54th while he's down in Beaufort, right? It's not like they're not running in the same circles. That you could very well, when I say, you know, Game of Thrones style miniseries, you could do it easily with that many characters.
Well, be careful, because those guys actually wanted to make a Confederacy show, which was super weird.
Actually, I want to get into that a little bit later on because the trailer for that for the new film Civil War came out today. I don't know if you saw film.
Oh no.
Oh yeah, there's a trailer.
Oh, good Lord.
No, I want to
You're
talk
scaring
about
scaring me.
No, I want to talk about the use of counterfactuals a little bit later on. But let's talk about now. We're talking about the Battle of Antietam. The United States is fighting this absolute fist fight of war. Adam just keyed on the fact that the federal government is in need of labor. This is not a war that is going well for the United States in 1862. Antietam is an absolute shit show of a fight. It's not really a victory for the United States. It's more of a stalemate, if anything, but it's just enough that Lincoln can call it a win and then later on issue Emancipation Proclamation. So I want to talk a little bit about the effect of the Emancipation Proclamation on people of African descent, both in the North and in the South, if you will, and talk about how that affects their lives and so forth. So can we talk a little bit about the Emancipation Proclamation in the United States under a sense of rebellion in 1863?
Can I take it from the Northern free people perspective?
That's what I was going to say. Holly, you start, now come in.
So for context for the audience, I'm speaking more so for my knowledge of New York State and Pennsylvania. So Black people, obviously everyone was talking about it, you know, Black churches. And I will say this for those who are really interested in engaging and learning more from the primary sources, read Black newspapers, the Weekly Anglo-African publishing out of New York City and the Christian Recorder publishing out of Philadelphia with the African Methodist Episcopalian Church. They're gold mines. And they talk a lot about the Emancipation Proclamation and its impact. But even before then, you know, there were things like calico dress events in which Black women were doing organizing to help free people as they sojourned outside of enslavement. I think the way I would, and I'm speaking generally here, I'll talk about some Black Northerners, there was a lot of excitement and hope, but at the same time, it's not enough. Right. And it's also a wartime measure. So what does that really mean long term? So there was some skepticism, but at the same time, it fundamentally shifts the meaning of the war for the United States officially. But to be clear, Black people and white abolitionists and others knew what this war was about always. Right. But it's like the Emancipation Proclamation shifting to now start the authorization of USCT regiments was great. But going back to Adam's point, like that, in a roundabout way, weirdly enough, dismisses further the U.S. Navy and Black military service within that branch, which is something I never thought about until just now. But I do think it's important to note that free Black people in the North especially have a different understanding of that document. And if we're being honest, we also need to note that which version? Are we talking the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation? Or are we talking the, right? Because the language within those two documents is fundamentally different.
Yeah, and I was going to say, to follow up on that, the Emancipation Proclamation, not only is it a wartime success, not all Black people supported Lincoln. Lincoln was inconsistent and very much clear that this wasn't a war about slavery. And they're like, oh, huh? Like, if it's not, are you an ally? So they're gauging him along the way. And the preliminary emancipation with the bids for colonization, and you can look at all those lovely records of where Lincoln is putting resources to ship Black people to, they're also seeing this and like, eh, we're not sure about this. But there, it's a wait and see attitude. But I will say this, we get one of our most important Black rituals and holidays, much more so than Juneteenth. That is watch night, December 31st, and waiting whether that thing is becoming official. And it takes a lot into the first before Lincoln makes that call in. But people are literally, is Lincoln actually going to put his like power and weight beyond the words? And when he does that, then you get overwhelmingly Black support. But right now, it's a wait and see. It's, is he going to do this? Is this a war about bringing people back together? Even Lincoln's policy is about returning contrabands of war and running away. All that stuff is not endearing people. And Jonathan White's book about African Americans making the White House their house, the Emancipation Proclamation helps because now they see him as an ally and not this person. Is he wishy-washy on race? What is he doing? How's it going? And they finally see him as an ally and not someone who supports their former people who want to keep African-Americans subservient. So I think about the Emancipation Proclamation and its limits, but I also think about it's a pulse of the Black experience and what this war meant for them, because their freedom, their citizenship, there's so much on the line, and the nation's not even considering it. Lincoln, this might endear them, but Watch Night, that still is celebrated to this day. That is the fundamental tradition that we need to start talking about. Like, what does this mean? That symbolic nature trumps everything else, I think, in some way, because that is the fate of what is future, what is past.
So down here on the coast of South Carolina, and January 1st, 1863, I mean, this one of the Reconstruction International Historical Park's core sites down here is the site of one of these massive Emancipation Day ceremonies, a site that Adam has never actually been able to go to. So I'm going to make that down as a note here. Despite his multiple visits to the area.
I think we're up to five, right? At least.
Because what I'm understanding now is that Adam Dombey does not support emancipation. But I'm just kidding. Adam's an emancipationist.
Oh!
Y'all know I love giving Adam a hard time. But I love Adam. One of the things that's really fascinating about that January 1st Emancipation Day here on the coast of South Carolina at a site called Camp Saxton is they did it at the military encampment of the 1st South Carolina Volunteers. This is the first of the first, the very first official Black regiment in the history of the United States Army. According to the regiment's colonel, like we even know who the first enlistee was, a guy named William Bronson, who is buried at Beaufort National Cemetery, about a mile from where I'm sitting. But they hold this ceremony at their camp. And for them, it's sort of this symbolic moment of because they read the preliminary one because that's the one that they have a copy of. For them, it's basically this message of saying, look, this is going to be kind of a weird sentence, but it's almost saying like, look, y'all are the experiment. You made it possible for the president to go, yes, we're going to take what you're doing national. And so it's this huge celebration down here. People come from all over. I kind of was only half joking when I said I was going to pull up this account from this guy. He's telling this story, years later, I think in like 19 teens, of being a kid walking with his grandfather, his elderly grandfather down to listen to the Emancipation Proclamation. Because for them, this was one of the spaces where the Emancipation Proclamation was applicable and where it was enforced, right? Like, so the Emancipation Proclamation means something different in Tennessee, which is exempt. It means something different in like middle Georgia where there's nobody to enforce it. But here it's applicable. It's in the coast of South Carolina. It's applicable and it's enforceable. And so that's happening. And so for these folks, it's this almost this moment, right? Watch Night, when the clock strikes midnight. And then when they have that ceremony, that's the moment they shift from being contraband to being, we are free. Not yet citizens, but don't know what, you're free. Like it is this moment. And to this day, I mean, like almost all of the Black churches around here, yes, they have Watch Night stuff, but they also have January 1st stuff. That is a huge deal down here. And there's a lot of pride down here in the community that, look, it's where they say, look, it was our ancestors, or they say it was their ancestors that sort of paved the way for men like the 54th. And Hillary, I love that you called them a national regiment. Like, I never thought about them that way. If it's okay, I'm going to absolutely like steal that language when we talk about the 54th.
I also think like the recognition of their humanity, that is profound, right? Like, that's a point too, that would make it undoubtedly inspiring and emotional. And so like that is fundamentally different than free-born people. And I think that is something for the audience that I hope, even just hearing this little snippet, is there are Black experiences, plural, not singular, right? Because I think sometimes when we talk about this period of time, we minimize or conflate, or whatever word you want to use, to slavery and freedom. But free-born Black people have a very different understanding and is just as important as those who are gaining and take their freedom.
One of the things that's really cool too about the emancipation process here on the coast, I keep saying here on the coast, like people know exactly where I'm. I've been Beaufort, South Carolina, Beaufort County, South Carolina. But one of the things I think that's really cool about that is, again, the army comes in, all the plantation owners flee. And then they start recruiting these soldiers, but they're being recruited into the army to serve basically in their communities. And that's something that's really kind of unique for just about anybody in the Civil War, especially in the U.S. Army. Like if you're a free black person from Ohio and you like Sojourner Truth's grandson who goes from Michigan to join the 54th Massachusetts, his name's Caldwell. I forget if his first name is James or Joseph. But, you know, if you're one of those folks, like, you know, you're leaving your family behind. Whereas here, like at Camp Saxton, I mean, you get people who are enslaved on the Smith plantation. Dad just walks across or brother or husband, whoever walks across a field, signs up, and he's right there. Like the kids can see dad carrying that musket. The spouse can see her husband carrying that musket. The mom can see her baby carrying that musket, and they all get to be there at that same day. There's like 7,000 people that show up at Emancipation Day at Camp Saxton, and there's like 800 guys in the regiment at this point. I mean, who's everybody else? It's their families, right? And so, you know, Holly, just listening to you talk earlier about, you know, centering that within your book. I mean, like I thought about it within the context of the Northern folks, but I never thought about it in that moment until you were talking earlier. So if nothing else, thank you for that.
Hillary, you were just talking about the experiences of black troops and what was at stake here. I really kind of want to underscore this and be very explicit about two different things. One is the idea of what black troops faced if captured or killed that maybe white troops did not. And I was hoping maybe we could really lay this out to understand there was a hell of a lot more at stake here for the soldiers of the 54th than just being killed or wounded in battle. So could one of you kind of jump in and let's talk about the very real fears of the soldiers involved.
I can do that. They have that moment.
Like everybody's tired of hearing from me.
Yeah, they have that moment. I mean, it's going to be Chris or I. We've both written on this together and published on it. But the threat is made in the movie. When you watch the movie, they talk about this order that's come down from the Confederacy that anyone captured is going to be executed, and they actually kind of get the details a little off on what the order actually said. What the order really says was that any African American captured in arms would be treated as an enslaved person up in arms, and they'd be sold back into slavery. And now, are they actually going to be captured? A lot of times they're going to be murdered instead. They're not going to take prisoners, right? At Fort Pillow, we see this. And so in reality, they're not going to take prisoners necessarily. And really, you don't see a lot of bayonet wounds in the Civil War, except when you have the USCT involved and suddenly people are using bayonets, right? There's this sort of viciousness that comes out in close combat that you don't get necessarily with other when it's white soldiers against white soldiers. But so they faced being sold into slavery. They faced potentially being murdered if they tried to surrender. And the white officers, it's listed, they do get that part right on it, that the white officers will be treated as if they are trying to raise insurrection. In other words, they're like John Brown number one, that we talked about tonight, not the second John Brown, but John Brown up in West Virginia, John Brown up in Virginia, who's going to be, they're going to be executed potentially. Now, you got to give Lincoln his props here, is that Lincoln's response is actually to say, hold it. If you do that, I'm going to put Confederate prisoners into hard labor. If you saw everyone you put into slavery, they're going to be in hard labor. For every officer you murder or you kill, right, I'm going to take a random Confederate officer who's surrendered, and I'm going to execute him. He says, no. Retaliation. There's a great book by Lorian Foote on this issue of retaliation and how it works. So all this is to say is that surrender is not an option in the same way. There are soldiers that surrender and they successfully surrender, but at least the risks are a lot more than what you see with white soldiers. And there's a great book on that as well. I'll just give a shout out to my good friend David Silkenet, all about surrender more generally and the act of surrender and how frequent surrender was during the Civil War, right? And you're talking about Pickett's Charge, more guys surrender in Pickett's Charge than die, which kind of goes, wait a minute. It kind of changes your perspective.
I was going to add one other thing is, again, not only is black soldiers in the 54th not treated as real soldiers, African Americans are being gathered up. So one of the things that this policy does is, okay, you're freeing people. Well, we're enslaving every Black person we encounter as slave. Doesn't matter if they are freeborn or not, which is why Gettysburg becomes a major issue, especially for Black Pennsylvanians who are now in South Carolina because they had enlisted in the 54th. And they're hearing about the three-week occupation of Central Pennsylvania and hearing about family members who are being gathered up and literally taken to either Richmond and being enslaved there. They're following these troops. Some of them go as far south as Alabama. And they're just like, we are hearing this. So they're also this helplessness because it inflicts on this other side that African Americans are just legitimate casualties where their bodies and manhood and personhood no longer matters because of the Emancipation Proclamation. And that's something that, seeing with the Valley of the Shadow, Ed Ayers' wonderful early D.H. part, but all of his books about Franklin County, Pennsylvania, and Augusta County, Virginia, really drives home for the Pennsylvania side. And I'm thinking about the Christie families, the Jacob families, and everyone else who are literally serving in South Carolina, writing back like, are you okay? Who got taken? Who did it? And they can't go back and fight because they're fighting on two fronts where they know they die. That's their family. But they're also seeing family getting seized because of their service and because of the Emancipation Proclamation allowed for the enlistment of Black men into formal U.S. military regiments. And I think about, what does that mean? It's more than a fight. It's like you're fighting for your family, but fighting for others, but also worrying about the home front at home while you're trying to serve a nation that doesn't respect you. And if you die, are they going to mourn you? Because the other side made clear that you're not, if you get captured, you're dead. I just want to think about the psychological effects. What does that mean? How do you serve?
This prisoner of war thing is, again, like anybody who knows me is probably already going, oh God, he's getting revved up now for real. It's actually a really important part of the 54th story that's not just for them, but bigger, like big picture for the whole war. And it's something that's not in the movie at all. So all this stuff, all these competing proclamations, oh, well, like, you know, so the Emancipation Proclamation, we're authorizing the recruitment of Black soldiers. Then there's the Libra. Then the Confederate government says, well, no, we're going to enslave people. Then the U.S. government issues the Libra Codes, which says, oh, nope, the U.S. Army knows no distinction of race. And then the Confederate Congress issues their own thing. And to be, from a military standpoint, this is all sort of a moot point until the 54th. There's and it's not in the movie, but there's about 25 guys that get from the 54th that are taken prisoner on James Island and then on the assault on Fort Wagner. How many more were murdered? I have no idea. I know you were talking about the bayonet thing a few minutes ago. I know Kevin Levine has been working on a biography of Shaw. Like, he was sort of cryptically talking the other day about like bayoneting. And so now I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to wait to hear about that. But when that book comes out, but there's about 25 of these guys that get taken prisoner. And when they go to exchange all the white prisoners to the U.S. Navy offshore, that exchange goes off and the white soldiers get out to the ships and the U.S. Navy's like, well, is this everybody? And the white soldiers are like, yeah, there's like these Black guys that are back there too. Like, some of the 54th guys are there. And that actually becomes the spark that leads to the breakdown of the entire prisoner exchange system. Like, it's no longer just an academic argument. It is the Lincoln administration says, well, if y'all aren't going to exchange all of our soldiers, we're not going to exchange yours. And so you can draw a straight line from the ramparts of Wagner to Andersonville, to Elmira, to late war Camp Douglas. I mean, to be blunt, over like the legal status of these 25 guys, and the Wagner guys, because they're, again, this national regiment. Again, I love that phrase. The government in Charleston, the state government in Charleston, actually arrests them. Like, they're not turned over to the Confederate military prison system. They're turned over to the state courts to be prosecuted under all these stipulations and under the state's laws. They get appointed an attorney. Okay. And the court, the judge in Charleston, actually rules that the state of South Carolina doesn't have jurisdiction because none of these men were enslaved. So we can't, the way the law was worded, it was re-enslavement. And he was like, well, none of these guys were slaves. So what are we supposed to do with them? Governor of South Carolina, these are your problem. And the governor's like, it's the Army's problem. And the Army's like, it's your problem. And so these guys just get tossed into the Charleston City Jail, where they sit for basically the rest of the war. There's about 25 of them, a number of them die in captivity. One of the ones who survives is Sojourner Truth's grandson. I'm messing up his first name if it's Joseph or James, but his last name's Caldwell. One of the famous photos of Sojourner Truth, she's actually holding a little tiny portrait in her hand, and it's his picture. And that's why she's holding that picture, is her baby's missing. So yeah, this whole like prisoner of war thing is something that's, it muddies the, like, if they were to include that in the movie Glory, it completely like changes the plot, the message. But it's something the men are aware of, right? I mean, James Gooding, who's one of the most prolific writers out of the regiment, he's got a letter to President Lincoln, like talking about like, hey, look, you know, you're telling the Confederates they better treat, that they have to treat us equally, but you're not paying us equally. Come on, man. What's the deal? Like, so all of these things all get, they're all intertwined with each other. But this prisoner of war thing with the 54th, like, it's the thing that's not in the movie that if you ever watch the movie with me, that I'm probably going to hit pause and just be like, okay, guys, we just have to stop now. And
time for a Chris Barr lecture.
Yes, time for a Chris Barr lecture, which I apologize for just giving.
Which I guarantee you're going to get in any conversation with Chris Barr, period.
That's also very true.
I just throw in one thought, and I think this is something that I didn't appreciate when I first started studying the war, is that we often talk about how the war was caused by slavery. And that's correct, right? The war was caused by slavery. But the war was also shaped by slavery and racism as much as it was caused. The way they actually fight is shaped by slavery. The strategies taken are shaped by slavery, right? There's a reason the Confederacy doesn't try a long guerrilla warfare of a decade long where they, you know, hide in the mountains and fight back. And that's because slavery would be dead by the time the war ended if they did that, right? They can't give up all of Virginia and just leave it like behind, which strategically actually might make sense from a military point of view, because there are enslaved people there and they would be freed. And so the very strategy that Lee takes is shaped by slavery and racism. And I think that's something that a lot of people miss. And it shows up in interesting ways in this movie as well.
I want to ask you guys, actually, you brought in two different things, and I want to do some myth busting right here. Just let's go ahead and put this to bed. I've been arguing with, listen, there is, and Adam, I want to come back to this a little bit later on towards the end, because I know this is really your specialty, because you're writing about some really, really important stuff right now. You know, where I'm from in Western Kentucky was a Confederate hotbed. Kentucky, like many of the states, was bitterly divided. There's still a statue of Robert E. Lee on my courthouse square. Kevin Levine, who was not with us here tonight, who will be on the pod a little bit later on to talk about Gettysburg, writes about this. Can we talk about the idea of Black Confederate soldiers? Were there enslaved Blacks fighting on? Let's go ahead. Let's put this to bed, because we're laughing right now. Holly's almost ready to fall out of his chair from a stroke right now.
No, I'm not laughing. No, I'm not laughing.
No, I've written a bit about this at this point. So I'll just say there are not Black Confederates. It's a myth. Literally, it's against Confederate law to give arms to African Americans until March of 1865, right? So the last month of the war, it's fallen apart. Everyone knows it's over. There's this debate that happens where they're like, wait, maybe if we give some slaves, some enslaved people, arms, they use the term slave, they wouldn't use the term enslaved person, right? Maybe we give some enslaved people arms, we can save slavery as a whole. And they begin trying to process this, and it's bitterly divisive. Many Confederates are like, no, don't do it, don't do it. If we do that, we are admitting that the whole point of this war is over, right? That they're actually men. We can't admit that. They're like afraid to admit that. But they finally are like, all right, we're going to free this small select group so that we have more manpower, but we're going to keep slavery. And it fails miserably. They never go enter combat. And we're not even sure they even organize. I mean, there's very little documentation at that point. So there aren't Black Confederates. What you do see is massive numbers of enslaved people mobilized by the Confederacy for their labor, right? They're digging trenches. They're building fortifications. They're in the camps, right? They're cooking for regiments. There's a great article by Patrick Lewis all about how the book Company H, which is this classic work, like ignores the fact that there's like tons. It's like there's a whole extra company essentially of people that is accompanying this unit, their regiment, because everybody's got a cook that they bring with them. And these guys are, some of them are running away. And it's worth noting also, when we talk about military service of African-Americans, even before the Emancipation Proclamation, you have a lot of African Americans who are working as servants for white officers as well. And some of them go on to join the USCT later, but some of them don't. And they're actually, you can actually make more money in like 1864. If you're a black guy in Maryland, you can make more money working as a servant to a white officer than you can if you enlist. The demand for that labor, because so many of these guys who were had been working in the service were basically like, I'm out, I'm joining the USCT now that I can, because they want to be part of this. They're willing to take a pay cut to take up arms. So there's this massive effort anyways to by the Confederacy to build up, use the labor to augment, but they don't want to arm them. You have also a few cases where you have black pilots who are basically forced to work for the Confederacy, where things get interesting. But
Robert Smalls.
Robert Smalls is working for them initially. And there's these moments where weird things happen, right? As there are in any war. But the thing about this myth, and that there's thousands of black Confederates, the reason it arises is it's essentially a way of saying, well, it couldn't have been about slavery. Because nobody ever fought against their interests anyways, right? That's a very solid, logical argument, if there ever was one. But that's kind of irrelevant, right? Is that, but it's this sort of like red herring of like, we're going to deny the cause of the war by pointing out, by trying to claim that all these people were fighting. So why would they have fought for something if the war was caused by slavery? And that's its purpose. And it really doesn't arise until the 20th century. There is an incident that I think is very telling about this, and then I'll be finished. I'll tell this one story. In about 1901 in South Carolina, one of these cooks, these guys who was taken to war by his enslaver, applies for a Confederate pension because he's like, I want some money. He's like, I'm willing to say I was a Confederate if he gives me money. And he successfully gets this pension, and he's getting money for his service. And it's all via paperwork, right? Nobody's seen him when he did this. He sends it off in the mail. Well, word gets around that there's a black guy getting a pension. And the Confederate veterans in 1901 in South Carolina freak out. I mean, they are ready to destroy the pension system rather than let this one guy have a pension. And the guy loses his pension because it is determined by the Attorney General of South Carolina that there were no black Confederates. So this guy could not have been a soldier because they weren't allowed to list. He's just a cook, and that doesn't count. Is what the Attorney General. So like literally the state of that these white supremacists who are the founders in many ways of the Lost Cause narrative are like, there's no way. And then it shows up in a later iteration of the Lost Cause. And I'll stop there because I've gone on way too long. But, you know, I wrote a book that has two chapters on this. You can go read.
Hillary and I have talked a lot about this. And this is one of the things that I loathe about doing Civil War history, depending on the audience. The only people that have ever asked me, are there black Confederates, do not look like me or Hillary. And that's really telling. I have never, ever, ever, ever had a black person or a brown person go, are there black Confederates? So the fact that it's coming from predominantly white people is very telling and actually affirms Adam's point, because it's like it almost to me feels like they're looking for validation that they're right. And here's the point. Everything Adam said and Kevin Levin and others have written, like, go read their work. In fact, and Adam's point is also highlights the complexities of Confederate, but also U.S. pensions, which I have written about and many others have. But I just want to be clear to the audience. Don't ask black scholars and brown scholars. Like, it's the most annoying question ever to ask. Like, I fucking hate it. That's as honest
all right. I will say my other issue is this is a white cosplaying fantasy. This is racial fantasy at its best. Some black folk who are willing to play into that fantasy because it's money. This isn't real. This is not real. And if it was real, I'm going to bring it back to glory. If it was real, then black USCT soldiers would have been exchanged. Because if black men were combatants, there'd be no issue, but there are issues. So just don't ask. That's always my first question that I get white scholars. And the first thing I also had to remind them to, like, yeah, my family served in the USAT and they came in April 1865. We're not all enslaved people either, but the Black Confederate myth that will not die because it's validation for those who refuse to see the agency of these people. And to accept Black Confederates, then you have to deny the heroism of the 54. But I always look at it now and think about Gloria New Way is, if Black Confederates existed, we would still have a prisoner of war exchange. We would have had all of it. It would never have been a problem. And we wouldn't have these random people trailing Confederate soldiers in these slave coffles. Because that's what these Confederate armies come when they go up north into these northern states. They are slave coffles. We wouldn't have that if they were legitimate soldiers. So we need it. I always think about civilians. I usually use the war of military, like combatants, non-combatants, to really talk about what we do when we have these African-Americans who do not fit. But yeah, the Black Confederate myth, it's a myth, people. Stop it. Just stop.
It's a myth, but like, God, and I just used the word "but" at the end of that sentence. That like, now everybody's thinking, "Oh God, what's Chris about to say?" No, but I do look, these guys, these men and women who are forced by the Confederate Army to carry out labor on behalf of effectively their own enslavement. Like, these are people whose stories in the archive have largely not been told, and the few times that they have been told has been in the service of the folks who want to turn them into Black Confederates. And that frustrates me because these are people who, like, their stories deserve to be told and deserve to be told honestly and authentically to the degree that they and their descendants are comfortable with. But it's a story that needs to be told, but they're not Black Confederates.
Yeah. And that's just where I love Robert Morrow. M-O-R-R-O-W of North Carolina. He follows his enslaver to UNC Chapel Hill, to West Point. He is highly educated. Well, when his enslaver gets injured in a battle, he goes to federal lines and enlists then. They're just biding their time. So I always see them as savvy operators, but how they come into the narrative. We have those who can't have choice because there's no consent when you're an enslaved person. You're property. There is no consent. But then those who are willingly freeborn people who become hired cooks, we have to do a whole host of differentiation. And I think we really need to think about what is the Black experience in the various points. And Black Confederate is one of the categories that will get busted, but we don't even understand how Black people before they go into uniform, are sutlers, they're other wagoneers, they're doing a whole host of other stuff. And I think this is where we need so much more work done. But the Black Confederate myth is the one that really draws the attention because we always want to put them there first and not the ones who are like, there's other people. Like, where are the children? Where are the laundresses? Where are the cooks? Where are the nurses? Where's the Susie King Taylors who I love?
Yeah, it's something that it's thinking about this, kind of coming back to the idea that we're talking about a movie, is it's something that's missing from basically every Civil War movie, but it's in some ways it's probably a good thing that it is missing. Because, like, for example, like at the movie Gettysburg, right? In the scenes where you're at the Confederate headquarters, like, there would realistically be just dozens of Black people, like, cooking, cleaning. Here you go, General. Would you like me to do that? I mean, like, you would see all these people. Even in Glory, like, the few shots we get of Confederates, like, there would be Black guys coming out to remove the dead. There would be, like, as they run into the fort, like, there might be, like, a little group of Black guys, like, kind of back in the corner, like, kind of hiding, like, all right, like,
fixing the fort during the bombardments. Fort Sumter has enslaved people die in it during the Union bombardment of the fort because they're out there trying to, like, put the walls back up because they're being forced to. They don't want to put the walls back up, just to be clear.
But yeah, so like we never see these people in popular culture depictions of the Civil War ever. But in some ways, like, I can't help but wonder if that's probably a good thing because, like, the moment we show, like, a bunch of Black guys hanging out around Confederate headquarters in the movie Gettysburg or around Confederate headquarters at Fort Wagner, like that just fuels the quote unquote myth even further, right? So, and that gets to that frustration I have of like, look, these are authentic, these are real people who have whose story deserves to be told.
And then also too, where are the women? Because we all talk about the families who don't leave their soldiers behind, who are traveling, and just the hospital scenes. And I'm just thinking,
here we go, Holly. Here we go.
I'm sorry that I had to put it out there. But where are the women? Where are the women who are there? Where are the women who are dressed up as men because they can't afford to have their partner be by themselves? And we have a lot more Black women who cross-dress so they don't separate from family. We barely know who they are. And it's not until they get injured. And I just think about if we expand out who's on the battlefield, who's in the camps, we have a different war. I think even the question we had earlier about North and South, federal versus everything else, starts to blow up because then it looks like a modern day military engagement where class starts to come into play and where these things come in there. But, and also I'm going to keep on plugging Susie King Taylor because it frustrates me no end that she gets no pay. She does that for free. Come on now. What about Black women volunteering their time for this type of work and they're not on the field?
I'll just to echo everything Taylor was saying. Firstly, to the audience, particularly those of you who are educators, Susie King Taylor's memoir is absolutely amazing. Like students I have taught, like love her work. Please read; it's so good. She talks about so much, and she gets minimized, and it pisses me off to no end. I want to come back to Hillary's point about the erasure of Black women's role in glory, specifically. Firstly, they were at Camp Reedville where they trained, and the soldiers wrote about it all the time. But I want to keep this more real and broadly. Scholars have written about this. I've written about this extensively. But there's also, if you just read the letters from soldiers, to be very clear, whether we're talking Iowa 60th, we're talking the 20th, 26th, 31st, the 3rd, the 68th, just in Pennsylvania, they were talking all the time that Black women were always there. In fact, at Camp William Penn, they had to actually mandate new policies to keep Black women from coming to the camp because they came so damn much, right? Like they were always there. In New York State, there was 40 Black women helped to organize what they called the Colored Ladies Organization to help Black soldiers to get access to clean water and medical treatment that they needed. Right. They're actually doing the service that the U.S. War Department is failing to do as they train. It pisses me off to no end how much Black women's important contributions, especially in the North. We obviously know what they're doing in the South. They're doing a hell of a lot in the North. And in addition to Black civilians, as I found at Camp William Penn, are getting married at the military campsite. I want to give a shout out to many scholars, including Tara W. Hunter and Chandra Manning, who have written about what they call marrying under the flag for freed people, but they were doing that freeborn too. So the fact that Black civilians, including children, were there all the damn time and to privilege able-bodied men only is very disrespectful to these people's realities. Because I'll tell you right now, at least the regiments that I looked out, the families were everything. Absolutely everything. One of the soldiers wrote in his enlistment document to his wife, that I'm going to die. And this is the only thing you will have to prove that you are legitimately mine. And like, that's the reality that we ignore. And I hate it. Sorry. I've been waiting for this moment.
That's your whole book. Like it's incredible talking about this, but even like circling this back to the movie, like itself and like the erasure of, you know, the perspective of Black women. I mean, like, never mind the fact that like there are just lots and lots and lots of Black women who would have been all over Beaufort County, Beaufort, South Carolina, who were all over the place. There are three incredibly famous ones who interface with the 54th. There's Susie King Taylor, who we have a memoir of. She's around, although by mid-June when the 54th gets here, a lot of them, I forget exactly where she's at that moment, but the a lot of the First South is down in Jacksonville that summer. But she's around. So that's, I mean, like even if they just, you could sprinkle Susie King Taylor into the movie very easily. Harriet Tubman, like most people don't know, she spends the entire Civil War here in Beaufort. And the scene where the 54th shows up in the movie and they meet the guys in the red pants, that's the second South Carolina Volunteers. They never wore red pants. That drives me crazy. But those are the guys. It's just a little trivia thing. I got to stitch count a little bit. But the Harriet Tubman has just brought back 750 people that she's liberated on the Cumbie raid. They get back the day before the 54th gets there. So the 54th is marching down Beaufort, marching down Main Street, and there are 750 people like that are recently just come off the rice fields. And I do love that that one soldier's like, oh, just round about here. And Harriet Tubman is there. Like, she gives a speech like the day that these guys get here. And so one of the books I'm most excited about coming out is Etta Fields Black's got a book coming out on the Cumbie raid. I think it's coming out in February of 2024 called Cumbie. That's going to explore that event from the perspective of one of the most important sources of Black people's voices during the Civil War, which is pension files. So she's using pension files to track families, descendants, things like that. So like you could have easily had Harriet Tubman as a major character in the movie Glory. And then the one who almost was a character in the movie Glory, they actually filmed scenes with her, is Charlotte Forton, who's a teacher at Penn School. At the scene, in the scene where they go out and they meet all the kids, and the kids are singing first, and the kids sing "My Country, 'Tis of Thee." That actually happened. The 54th went to the 4th of July celebration at Brick Baptist Church, Penn School, and the students all came out and sang. And Shaw, Colonel Shaw, and Charlotte Forton, who is an African American teacher who's at Penn School, get kind of close. Like, they become friends. They strike up sort of some correspondence, and they actually filmed some scenes with her. That if you find like the out, there's like some deleted scenes where you can find where like she's in some of them. And if you know who to look for, because Charlotte Forton was mixed race, and so the person that they got to play her is fairly, I don't really word this, but she's fairly light skinned. And so in sort of the background, she's in some shots. If you know the actress you're looking for, you can actually spot the Charlotte Forton actress in that scene. She doesn't stick out, I guess, because she's just sort of in the background because they deleted those scenes. But yeah, I mean, like, that's three people that would have been just sort of easy. That would have been, I mean, you're making a movie, right? You have to have people have heard of that are famous, I guess. But you've got three right there that would have added a lot of depth and complexity to this movie. And we have first person accounts from two of the three of them. Incredible first person accounts from two of the three of them.
Well, Charlotte Forton has her diaries. I've used them quite a bit. She talks about her experiences in South Carolina. So, yeah.
The Atlantic Journal that they just republished, the Reconstruction issue from December of 2023, they reprinted some of Forton's essays that she wrote in The Atlantic based on her time here on the coast of South Carolina.
And can I just say, she wrote one of the most powerful poems eulogizing the 54th. If you haven't read it, you can tell how much this regiment impacted her. And it is beautifully written. It covers most of the Northern papers, but it's a Black woman who experienced this regiment, and it's the perfect eulogy. And it's within 2 weeks of the aftermath of that particular battle.
I want to ask you guys about Robert Shaw. So much of this film and so much of our discussion is rightfully rooted in Black experiences. But I do want to talk about Matthew Broderick, who is really kind of our lens into the film. I find oftentimes talking about, at least in my own mind, and I kind of get in my own headspace sometimes because I think it's very easy to be cynical about the world around us. But can we talk about Shaw for a moment? Is Shaw a believer? Is he a real believer? Who is Robert Shaw? Like, who is this guy? Because I feel like he's important to understand this character, this man and character as we're seeing him, to understand why decisions are made to depict him in certain ways so that we understand the film and also the history behind the film.
Yeah, I think this is where we need Kevin in here. He's working on the biography to answer some of these. But for me, I think the thing that we lose and that the movie does a decent job of capturing.
Well, actually, Douglas Egerton is working on a book on him.
Oh, yes, Douglas Egerton. Yeah, yeah. His book. Oh, yeah. If anybody's not read that, like, think about the 54th, Douglas Egerton's Thunder at the Gates. Incredible book. You know, the thing we forget about Shaw is that he's like 25, 26, something like that. I mean, he's basically... And he's like, just, he's a rich kid from college. Like, his parents are hardcore believers in this abolitionist stuff, but like, he's 25, 26 years old. He's in charge of 1,000 free Black men, mostly free Black men who have come from all over the North. Again, this national regiment, God, I'm stealing that. That's such an incredible phrase. With citation, of course. And he's in charge of this. And we're asking, well, who is he? I think he's still figuring out who he is. I think this experience is shaping who he is. And who he is as yet to be determined when they charge up the ramparts of Wagner. I don't think he knows who he is in that moment.
Well, who does at 25, right?
I mean, I don't. I'm 40 and I don't know who I am.
Honestly, I think this is one of the things, as much as I hate white savior narratives, because it's a white savior narrative. Like, I'm not going to lie, but the fact that he is so young, he didn't really know himself. He's just like coming of age. He's wishy-washy. I'm sorry. He's a wishy-washy white man. He writes somebody, so he doesn't know where he's coming into this stuff. But at the same time, one of the things I like about him, which is emblematic of so much, I use him to talk about Lincoln. A lot of white Americans who support the federal cause are not pro-black. They're not pro-civil. They have to come into this. And he comes into his come to Jesus moment through experience and interactions with black people. He is not the rabid abolitionist of his parents or other Bostonians. And in fact, this is why I think even his relationship with Thomas in there is, he's tangential. That's the pet. That is the acceptable white Brahmin pet that he has. He has to come to his own. So it's a coming of age story that I think is really beautiful. But Shaw, he wasn't a rabid abolitionist. I think he sees it as promotion, but also too, I think he sees it after surviving Antietam as a way to survive the war and not get killed. And so for me, he's no different than any of the white men that I look at who go to college campuses to get their degrees in the middle of the war and their parents shoot them off. They're like, there. But by the end, that is his more authentic self. He is committed and willing to die. But it takes the last part of the film in the week and a half of him really being in South Carolina, being in that heat, being in that impossible task that he has. But at the beginning of the war, no, he's like most Americans at that point. And that's one of the things that I do appreciate about the film. It has a lot of problems because I think you could have centered some other people, not him. But one of the other things is he had the best PR campaign because his family made sure his memory was kept alive.
Oh, yeah.
How many schools get named after him? How many Grand Army Republic things? That's all mom. That's everyone. Like, that's why we know Shaw. It wasn't because he was remarkable. He had a good PR after he died.
In the months after Wagner, a lot of the white ministers here in Beaufort started trying to raise money from the black church congregants to erect a monument in Beaufort to Shaw. And basically, like, the black people here are like, wait, what? Like, who, that guy? He was here like a week. I mean, he's basically in this area for a couple of weeks. And they're going like, hey, why don't let's raise money for, like, our husbands and fathers and brothers and kids. Like, and so the monument obviously never gets raised, but one of the camps that's here in downtown, just a few blocks from where I'm sitting, the army renamed it Camp Shaw. And so, like, in the late summer of 1863, there's, you know, the 1st South Carolina, 2nd South Carolina, they're in camp there, Camp Shaw, the famous photo of the 29th Connecticut Infantry, the big row going past the oak tree. I have some really exciting stuff with that photo that we've just kind of maybe figured out today. But that's taken around Camp Shaw. But yeah, I mean, the memory thing on him is really interesting. And so, Hillary, I know this is Jason's podcast, but I want to ask a question for all of you all, especially Holly, Hillary, and Adam. The movie centers Shaw. If we were to, like, I forget who made the movie, Columbia or somebody. If they came in and said, we're going to remake Glory, but Shaw's going to be sort of a tangential background character. Who are we centering this movie on?
Oh, that's easy. Lewis Henry Douglas, Frederick Douglass's son, like, who writes that lovely letter to his wife about what happened, how he survived. And he's like, I don't know what happened, but I barely survived, dear girl. He's like, it's loving, it's there, and he's trying to explain his words. And it's Frederick Douglass's son, like, and who comes out somewhat whole at the end because his other children who serve really have some post-traumatic stress and really mentally have to deal with the war. But he had the letters. He had the powerful father. He survives it. And he gets a promotion from it. Who not better but a black soldier who's the son of Frederick Douglass?
Holly, who do you think? Who would you do?
So I would actually say the families, because one of the biggest, I don't want to say problems, there's scenes from the movie where I immediately think of the families that these men are talking about, right? So the famous scene in the one of where they do the tear it up, right? And that was clearly a response to the denigration of their manhood in terms of the failure of pay from the U.S. War Department. But I'll tell you right now that a number of Northern Black families were saying, what the hell are you doing? We need that damn money. So I think highlighting that contestation over that is important, but also, you know, the campfire scene where Morgan Freeman says, you know, I left my kin. I think he says Bundy. I'm not really sure like the location he says. I struggle with that because I want to know their story too, right? Because to put the context of the part that breaks me every effing time is when Denzel says, and I'm already getting chills just seeing it in my head, y'all's is the only family that I got. That fucking breaks me, right? Because I think about, you know, what slavery at its core was really about, was the denigration of Black humanity and the lack of recognition of family structures and all that shit, right? And it's just like Denzel's pain of not having a family that he can like even write a letter to. Like they're telling you in that film repeatedly, families are everything.
So like set the movie, like so the movie, like we'd never actually see the 54th in South Carolina. Like it's like the movie set in like set in New Bedford, and we're following Ellen Gooding, who's James Gooding's wife. And James Gooding is writing all these letters to the New Bedford Mercury. And like, I can see like all the women, like all the spouses cutscenes. Yeah, sure. And all the spouses are coming up like every time a paper comes out because, hey, they're James wrote a letter.
Acknowledging they're part of the story.
Yeah. That would actually be a really interesting, like I would. Opening day, I'm there.
So I'm going to go with another individual, John Oakey, who I'm still researching actually for a project I'm working on right now. But I think, and I haven't confirmed it, that it's the same John Oakey, but I'm pretty sure it is. He runs away from slavery in Maryland. And nobody ever talks about Maryland bordered slavery. So he's like an interesting figure to begin with. So he runs away. He ends up living in various places up north after he's escaped slavery. And then he joins the 54th, right? And he survives. But you got the runaway story to start it off. And it really shows that it's a national regiment. And that this is a fight for freedom for them, right? This isn't a fight for union for them. There's that – one of the things that I do like about the film is when he sort of is like, I'm not going to carry the flag because – I'm not fighting for union, right? I'm fighting for something else entirely. I'm fighting to free my family who's down south. And so I pick, and it doesn't have to be the one I picked, right? This is just the one I'm researching right now. I pick one of the many enslaved people who ran away before the war begins and then joins up so that you can tell that story of this is part of a longer struggle for freedom. And it continues after the war. The other person I'm going to include. Actually, I'm going to keep that one secret until I publish on it.
I feel that.
I can't tell that one. Once I publish on it, I got another one coming, but it's good.
The guy who I feel like should have been a major character in this movie, but he isn't, and it would have been an easy addition, is again, I've referenced him a couple of times. That's James Gooding, right? He's writing all these letters. So much of what we have sort of in public anyway about the perspective of from the perspective of the enlisted men comes from him. He's a prolific writer. He's incredibly well-educated. He's educated at the New York Colored Orphans Asylum, which going back to the New York draft riots, burned down in that. One of the tragic things with him is his widow receives word that he's killed at the Battle of Alusty. So she's filing for widow's pensions, but he wasn't killed. He was actually still alive while she's filing the widow's pensions. He actually died. He's one of the few men who actually ended up at Andersonville. One of the few Black soldiers ended up at Andersonville. He's died there, buried there in a year and a day after Wagner. Buried in grave 3585 in Andersonville National Cemetery. But I wouldn't necessarily center the story around him, but like he basically is my Thomas character, right? I mean, because in many ways, like he is, in my brain, he's Thomas. Like he's incredibly well-educated. I mean, he's writing poetry, for God's sake, like in his writings. He lived in the same town as Melville. Like, I mean, I can almost sort of see him talking about like, oh, well, have you read The Transcendentalist today? Like that's Gooding in my brain. But he's sort of the avenue to explore for me all these other rich characters. And the guy who I think that if I'm remaking this movie, it's got to be Carney for me. It's got to be William H. Carney.
And again, you're bringing in New Bedford, someone who grew up in Massachusetts, and Carney's descendant, who was a part of my education in the 80s, who came in and talked to Black children in Brockton Public Schools and the Boston area schools about Carney, about his thing, the New Bedford community. And I also give a plug for the Pennsylvania community. There's a lot of Black Pennsylvanians from Franklin County, Gettysburg, Adams County. Like, this is one of the things that I always think about when I think about what Ed Ayers does, but also my work on Pennsylvania. How many of them enlist in the 54th and then 55th because Thomas Morris Chester recruits them? They are recruited specifically from Ohio and in Pennsylvania. What happens if we center that recruitment drive to get Black men who have never left the state of Pennsylvania? They might have gone down to Maryland because it's right there and it's convenient. But they've never gone to a winter like New England. They're taking the train to war. Then they're taking boats. So they're doing all these new things. But it's not, they are fighting for something larger than just being a Massachusetts. It's that larger vision. And then they come home and survive. So this is one of the things that I'm going to plug. The Black Cemetery Projects of Pennsylvania, Zion Union Methodist Church, the Chambersburg Black Cemetery, the Shippensburg Cemetery, where my family members are from, Locust Grove. There's nothing but 54, 55th, and Black USCT. They're all there. But they come home and survive. Can we talk about those who survive Get Wagner and not just those who died?
Yeah, one of my favorite Carney pictures, he's the postman.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want the post-war story. And so actually, I'm going to tell you guys this.
I knew that was going to take 4 minutes for Adam to be like.
I had to. It's too good a story. Chris is going to start 100%. Using it. It's fine.
Chris is ripping everybody off tonight. Go on.
So there's this guy. There's this guy, Lewis West, who he's enslaved in Northern Virginia. And early in the war, he runs away and he ends up giving intel to Union troops across the Potomac on his way to freedom, right? And his story could have disappeared then, but it doesn't. He moves to Pennsylvania for the first part of the war. He runs away in like, I want to say it's early 62, but don't quote me on it. I don't have my notes in front of me. So he runs away and he gains his freedom, right? He literally just takes matters into his own hands and runs across the border. And so you got a great story there. Then joins the 54th. He serves throughout the war in the 54th bravely, right? He's at all the battles, but he survives. And this goes back to what Hillary says. And here's where it gets fun. So he ends up married and he ends up working as Thaddeus Stevens' body servant, right? And he's there when Thaddeus Stevens is introducing all those Reconstruction Acts. Who's the guy that's taking care of Thaddeus Stevens so that he can do all this legislating that's going to bring freedom to African Americans in the South? It's Lewis West. He's there. And when Thaddeus Stevens is on his deathbed, who's he talking to? Lewis West. Lewis West is in the room when Thaddeus Stevens dies. He's in the funeral procession. And when they bring him into the Capitol, who brings him in? It's a group of USCT soldiers and Thaddeus West. I'm sorry, it's Lewis West. I'm getting Thaddeus, my name's mixed up, right? He's there with him and he's in the Wills. I mean, Thaddeus Stevens couldn't do his work without this guy, right? The work that was so important for Reconstruction, right? This is Thaddeus Stevens is the legislator who's putting through the Civil Rights Acts and the Reconstruction Acts, all these acts that are just fundamental to African Americans having rights, and he's behind them. He's sort of, you know, the supporting character in that moment because he can't be in the legislature at that moment, right? He's not able to be elected in 1866, right? They're not yet having African American legislators be another couple of years. And when Thaddeus Stevens' common law wife, according to some folks, dies, she includes Lewis West in the will and his wife in the will. I mean, this was a man who knew the Thaddeus Stevens family, right? The Stevens family is part of that family. He's brought in. He's clearly very close. Nobody's ever written on him as far as I know. And I'm just starting this project, so I don't know where it's going to go. But I'm hoping to find more on this guy. But like the after effects, like these people don't stop fighting. They keep fighting. They're involved in politics. There's members of the 54th. that are involved in Reconstruction era politics and later, right? They're voting, they're running for office, they're showing up at Republican Party conventions locally, and this is all documented. Like, we know this. And so to me, Hillary's right. It's all about the after effects. And I know nobody steal my story and publish it before.
Oh, I'm looking up West's very upset service record right now.
And thank you for the shout out to Lydia Hamilton Smith. I went to school in Franklin Marshall. I've been to her grave, Thaddeus Stevenson's grave. There's so much stuff when we talk about even the Pennsylvania story in there. And I'm not going to harp about it. As someone who's born and raised, I was born in Boston, Fenway Park. So, Jason, I'm not going to comment on your shirt that you have right now. I'm not the avid Red Sox fan, but I did grow up across the way from there. But what do we do when we include those who are not typical? Which goes to why I think one of my pet peeves of the film, they use composite characters. There could have been so many real people they could have drew upon. And I'm like, but you gave us, I'm not going to lie, you gave me a favorite cast. Because Tripp, Thomas Searle, like, I'm like, come on now. I will take them hands up. But what happens if it was Gooden? What happens if it was another person who was known? What could have happened if these were real people, not composite characters? How that might have transformed even the Lewis West of the world or the Carneys. If we would have even put Rollins' character as Carney, that I think would have been something different and could have made this film even more impactful than what it was. And I'm not going to say, I'm not knocking Glory. I think it did transform it, but I also think about what was lost because we didn't include real people.
The composite character led to this like William H. Carney like erasure that like kind of drives me a little bonkers sometimes, because like they make this big deal about like, if this man should fall, who will carry this flag? And Thomas steps forward, I will. And now I'm going to cry thinking about that moment. But like, where's William Carney, man? The old flag never touched the ground. Like, the man is literally awarded a Medal of Honor for hauling that flag over those ramparts. And when he gets back, he's shot to pieces. He's treated in a hospital that house still stands. It is two blocks from where I'm sitting. I walked past it this morning. And he's awarded the Medal of Honor because he made sure that flag never touched the ground. And it kind of drives me a little bonkers that, like, who's going to hold this flag? Well, I will. And then he hits the ground. And that just like what would that have done for young kids or like when they watch this movie for the first time to like see this guy and the movie and going back to maybe you know, it's somebody who the movie's following somebody who survived, and the movie ends with the president of the United States. Whenever I think he's awarded the medal in like 1900 or something. I forget the exact year, but you know, you have President McKinley or whoever pins that medal on his chest and says, you know, well done, soldier. Like, yeah, I'm trying not to cuss tonight because I'm not officially in an official capacity, but everybody knows who I am. So it's like.
Or even end it with the unveiling of my favorite monument in Boston. Like, those men are showed up, like, saluted. Like, that classic image.
Yes.
Not only are they survived, they have a monument put up to them that's across the street from the State House. Like, it's that presence, that awesomeness that I think is really think that was a missed opportunity. And if we would have brought in Carney or even that part, we could have had a little bit more in there. And I think this is one of the things where I think about Matthew Broderick's character in there. Like, we ended with him in that convenient death, but that allows me to talk about how even he, the white privilege Boston Brahmin child, was treated like every other officer who was just rolled in the open grave and buried. And that lack of dignity and death that happened, and using the quote of the Confederate soldiers talking about how they buried him with a pejorative. That type of thing is lost because we focus on him. But if we brought in Carney, brought in the survival, brought in even the Boston Monument, we would have had a different ending in a way that would have said, like, and they persisted. And they were honored by the people who mattered the most in this height of lost cause erasure. These men were honored in their lifetime. That would be beautiful.
I actually, Hillary, you're actually bringing up a really good point here. This is probably a natural segue into, and we've been hinting at this all night. One of the real strengths of a recent Civil War film, Free State of Jones, is that it does carry the film forward into Reconstruction. And I want to talk about, and Adam, this is really kind of some of your recent work here, but about the memory of the war now, as we start to think about, and Hillary's just talking about some of the memorializations of the film, things like that. I want to talk about why it's important, how we think about the war now, what these monuments mean, both monuments to the 54th, but also these Confederate monuments. I want to talk about the myth of Robert E. Lee as this reluctant Confederate. Can we talk about what's at stake here when we talk about remembering the war now? As I told you guys earlier, there's still a goddamn statue of Robert E. Lee on my courthouse square in Murray, Kentucky, western part of the state, which to this day, folks, points towards the traditionally black part of town, right? Erected by the Daughters of the Confederacy in 1921, very real reasons. Can we talk about the memory of the war reflected through this film?
Yeah. Let me just dive in here for a second on this, because the question of monuments, I have some thoughts about, believe it or not. And I think Kentucky is actually a great place to start, because Kentucky, you know, I forget who said it, but there's a great book on it. And I'm forgetting its title right now, but Hillary will probably remember. Making a Confederate Kentucky. Thank you. That, you know, Kentucky is the only state that joins the Confederacy after the war, right? 2/3 of the men who serve from Kentucky, who serve in the military during the war, either military, 2/3 of them serve in the U.S. Army. The other third serve in the Confederacy. So the majority are serving for the Union. Yet somehow there are not U.S. monuments all over the state. They're Confederate monuments all over the state. It's mind blowing, right? The success at rewriting history that Kentucky demonstrates. So when I'm thinking sort of about the memory of these things, these monuments, why they matter, I'm going to go back to the rise of Jim Crow. They justified Jim Crow using a narrative of history that said African Americans are not capable of being part of democracy. They're not capable of serving. And part of that memory involved the erasure of the USCT. Because if the USCT fought valiantly, then wait a minute, they deserve citizenship, right? There's this whole military citizenship thing that I'm sure Holly and Hillary can talk about much better than I can. And I'll hand it over to them in a minute for that. But they have to erase all the contributions of African Americans. And what do they replace it with? The lost cause, this myth of the war, which is basically premised on a few things. The first being that the war wasn't about slavery. And let's be clear, they're rewriting the cause of the war not because they're embarrassed about slavery, but because slavery lost. Slavery's dead. If you fought a war for slavery and it's 1890, what are you? Loser. If you fought a war for states' rights in 1890, what are you? Well, you're a winner. States' rights are still around. And in fact, it's the crucial tool being used in the rise of Jim Crow to oppress African Americans. That's why they rewrite the cause of the war. And then they're like, slavery's benevolent, they claim. It's not. Let me just be very clear, right? Slavery is a violent extraction of labor based on violence, murder, and the separation of families. I mean, it is literally based on torture, right? That's what it is. There is no defense for it. But they rewrite it, that it's this benevolent institution, because what that allows you to do is if you then rewrite Reconstruction into this period of corruption, which it was not. There's no more corruption in Reconstruction than any other era. But if you rewrite it that way, then what is the overturning of Reconstruction? The returning of society to an idyllic model. You're going backwards to when things worked well. So you have to rewrite things so that slavery worked well for everybody. And you write Reconstruction as being a disaster, even though it actually works better. That's why we have public education. Hillary Green wrote an amazing book, Educational Reconstruction, that all of you should go buy if you haven't already, that is all about this. And so to me, what's at stake? Who gets included in as an American? I mean, there's the great book, Confederates in the Attic, right? Tony Horowitz's lovely book. I mean, one of the things he says is like being part of the Civil War is how you become an American, right? He talks about this. Well, if we write African Americans out of the Civil War, they're not American. That's a problem. There are people in this society who would like to do that again unfortunately, Nazi African Americans be able to vote, right? And that can be justified if you're like, well, they're not real Americans. Bullshit, I say. And I'll curse, sorry, for those of you who aren't allowed to. I'm allowed to. The joys of tenure. But, you know, so it's what's at stake? Who gets to belong in the United States? Who owns our history? Who is an American citizen? Still at stake. And so the stakes could not be higher in my mind in many ways, because what we see is that Jim Crow rose and we saw the end of democracy in the American South. And that can happen again if we don't pay attention to both what's going on presently and how history is misused and abused.
And then also, too, it was done violently. And one of the things that I always, when I talk about this, is Coretta Mitchell's book about From Slave Cabins to the White House. She comes up with a term on know your place aggression. And Jason, it's not any accident that Confederate monuments are facing the Black community. You dare cross this railroad track and you don't act right, you're dead. Because the willing use of violence to curb any dissent. So one of the things I get pushback on sometimes when I talk about Black responses to Confederate monuments, they're like, well, no one publicly objected. I'm like, yeah, because they value their life. If they said anything, they were killed. So silence doesn't mean complicity. It means survival tactic and this underground thing. So even having oral resistance, and I'm thinking about Charleston and how Black communities spat upon John C. Calhoun, they used shoe polish, they used spray paint. They even started singing John Brown's Body anytime they went uptown. Like, that is resistance. But it's not changing the thing, because white communities knew if they needed to, they can put in the full war force of the state. So it's anti-democratic with the full weight that people's lives don't matter to justify this narrative. And Black people are always reminded when you come in, you might think, but in this place, you are less than, you are subservient. And it's that racial geographies and the violence behind it and the rewriting of history. This was a strategic plan in which the monuments is a symptom of a society that goes back beyond 1865, goes back to rewrite the past. And I think right now we're seeing a different rewriting, because it's about 50 years and we're seeing this on the civil rights movement. The willing discussions of violence, the willing use to say textbooks are wrong. It's the same playbook as the UDC. It's the same playbook of John Knox of Alabama in the Constitutional Convention saying that they wanted white supremacy by law and not fraud. It's the same thing why we have racial massacres and assassinations and banishments of whole communities that got erased. Tulsa was not the exception, but the norm. But we have a whole host of people who were killed if they spoke out. And that willing use of violence, and I think about the Civil War, goes hand in hand. And even people who dare to speak out, and I'm going to give a plug to Liz Varon's new book on James Longstreet. He has no monuments because he supported Black freedom and Black allies in New Orleans. William Mahone of the Readjusters has no monuments to him because he supported Black freedom, Reconstruction Project. So even who gets lionized or not, it all comes back to, did they support Black people and what the war was about, even though they served in the Confederacy or not? If you were seen as a race traitor, white or Black, your life didn't matter. And I think that's one of the part of the memory part that really, and the monuments, it's a whole bunch of erasure of history, an intentional political history, because it's politics to erase and the politics to ignore. And that is highly an issue at hand, that these monuments were never neutral, but very much conveyed a certain sensibility of what is possible and who is not included in the nation.
I'll just add briefly, and this is just doing many different talks, is of descendants of USCT soldiers in Kentucky and in Pennsylvania and other places that I've presented have told me to my face that since the public and historians don't, and the federal government does not care about us then, that like they feel so devalued now about their importance to American history. So I think we also need to recognize the trauma upon descendants. And this goes beyond just talking about African-Americans, historically marginalized people. Like you, we need to understand what is actually happening to the families and the communities who are being, to echo everything that was just said, they don't matter. It still impacts these people today.
Thank you, Holly, for that, because I have been in conversations with folks from home, and I think you all know that like these conversations you can have at one level, and then you go back home to your hometown, and it's a completely different fight because I'm no longer esteemed. I'm no longer the expert in whatever. I'm just the guy that went that grew up with your kid, you know. And it is an impossibly frustrating aspect. I want to ask you guys this as we start to come back to a close. Aside from Glory, which despite, you know, some of his faults, and listen, folks, we're not counting rivets here. Chris referred to counting threads earlier today. That's not what this pod has ever been about, or not what HATM is about, because there's never going to be a perfect thing. You can only put so much history into a two and a half hour film. Then we start to say the movie is too long, right? But aside from Glory, what's a Civil War movie that you dig for whatever reason? Can you give us one movie and then one book? The list of books that have been listed, that have been named on this, have already set a record, and I've been scribbling the whole time. So I'm going to ask you to list a different book, and it can't be Shelby Foote's book because we haven't even gotten into the Shelby Foote thing. Otherwise, we'd be here for another hour and a half. But one movie, one book.
All right, I'll go first. I'm going to go with, and it has its problems. It has its problems. Free State of Jones as a movie, because it has Reconstruction. It does have elements of it where it's almost a white savior narrative, except for the fact that he fails to save anyone. And so it's a failed white savior narrative, I guess you could say, which does, you know, there are things I would change if I were making that movie today. The book I'm going to shout out to because of what I study is going to be Marching Masters, Slavery, Race, and the Confederate Army During the Civil War. For anyone who's confused about sort of what people fought about, and what Confederates believed and how devoted they were to white supremacy, that book does a wonderful job of just taking apart that element of the myth, right? By Colin Woodward, that really does a good job of saying, like, look, Confederates, here's what they believed. And it's eye-opening to someone if they've grown up with the Lost Cause being told that everyone who's fought for the Confederacy was a great guy, who believed in egalitarian and was fighting alongside Black Confederates or whatever. It disabuses you of that notion.
So I will say Free State of Jones, because it includes those who didn't agree with the Confederacy and did something else, but also it's one of the best scenes of a Reconstruction school that I've ever seen, and the aftermath of the war in a community where that violence doesn't stop. And that's, I love that one altogether. The book I would recommend is New Bedford Civil War by Earl Mulderlinc III, because I'm a New Englander through and through, and the New England Black community who enlisted in larger numbers, especially in the 55th, the sister regiment that does not get the love that they should get, really brings in and situates a Kearny. It situates a vibrant Black community of whalers and sailors, because they also serve in the Navy too. But also they will be instrumental for how the war gets remembered and persisted in after the wars too, because they remember their sacrifice writ large. So it's not just individuals, it's an entire community who goes to war and fight. So you get a sense of why people participate in this small New Bedford town. And plus you have Herman Melville there from Moby Dick, who's from that community as well.
Oh, yeah. I was hoping that like we would run out of time and I wouldn't have to answer this one, because it's so hard. It is. And multiple people have already said Free State of Jones. I can't say that one. I
mean, Do you want to say Free State of Jones? It seems like that's really, when we talk about these films, there's Glory and then maybe Free State of Jones.
Well, so
it's come the closest to Glory.
I feel like the next hour's worth of this conversation is me arguing that Star Wars is a Civil War film, but I'm going to go with that. I'm not going to do that because we're going to be here all night and
Holly's going to eat. We got to deal
with. I got to eat.
I'm going to fall asleep in this chair.
No, like it's one of those things. Like there's there's a lot of Civil War movies that like I like parts of them. Like they illustrate like maybe one cool aspect. Even some of the ones that are just horribly just lost cause problematic. Like there's look, I mean, I was 13 years old or 10 years old when Gettysburg came out. Like, look, I got a little soft spot for that big giant. But I also like recognize that like it's the issues with it.
You can love and criticize something though.
We do it to you, Adam, all the time.
I know we're up to seven criticisms of Adam tonight. I was counting.
It's low.
So I'm gonna. It's not my favorite, but I think it's the most important Civil War film, and it's one we've referenced once already. And that's it's Gone with the Wind. Like it's not a movie that I want to sit and watch much more than about once a year, but like. I recognize that it is a quote-unquote cinematic masterpiece. Like, the characters are all well-written. It's cinematically beautiful. It's got characters. It's got a plot, which is something that, to be blunt, a lot of Civil War movies fail to do. They sort of try to both sides the war. It's partially why Glory is so good, is they don't try to both sides the war and show you, like, bouncing back and forth. It's got this lovely plot, you know, but it's also incredibly important for thinking about this all this memory stuff that we just did. Like if Margaret Mitchell never wrote that book and if they never made that movie, like the memory of the war is totally different. Like it mainstreamed this in a way that nothing else ever has. As far as favorite books, oh, that's a dangerous one.
Favorite book. One.
Book. So
one. It's not fair.
I'm always a flavor of the week kind of guy. Like my favorite book is the one I haven't gotten to read yet. And it's Etta Fields Black's new book coming out on the Cumbie Raid, just because I'm super excited about it. But if I can't answer a book that I haven't read yet, although, you know, she and I've talked a lot about it. Instead of something that's like a history, like a monograph, I'm going to go with On the Altar of Freedom. It's the edited letters of James Gooding. I've mentioned Gooding multiple times now tonight. Like, that when I started working at Andersonville, like Gooding was the first of my guys. I began almost every cemetery tour at his grave, reading his letter to the president. I was teaching at a high school at the time. I was actually volunteering at Andersonville. I was teaching at a high school. One of my students got really into it, and he came out sort of volunteering and like dressing up and portraying James Gooding. Like, that's just my guy. I've stood in the Siemens Bethel where he got married while reading his widow's pension. But his letters are just absolutely incredible. And so of all the, I mean, again, it's not going to give you any sort of great, big, crazy arc of thesis or anything like that, but it's just a voice from the Civil War that most people have never heard. And it's just incredible. So On the Altar of Freedom, we now know more about Gooding's life than what the editor did at the time. And Gooding had put in his service records that he was born free in Troy, New York. We now know, especially thanks to the work of Douglas Egerton, who really dove in on Gooding's story, that that's not the case. That Gooding's got a much more complex backstory to that. But yeah, go find you a copy of On the Altar of Freedom.
Holly, what you got for us?
All right. So if I was going to pick a film, it would be Gangs of New York. And for the simple reason, one, it depicts the New York City draft riots. But the other thing, and I use it a lot in class, is to highlight the pro-Confederate, the anti-blackness of one of the most important cities. And people often forget that Fernando Wood, the mayor of New York City, openly like basically call for New York City to secede from New York State or from the Union and join the Confederacy, which made zero sense. And then I would say not a book, actually a dissertation of the late Megan J. McClintock. She's passed away. I put her dissertation, which is actually in conversation with Brandy Brimmer's book, which is also amazing, Claiming Union Widowhood. But if I'm being honest, like, Megan McClintock's dissertation, I would put up against most books that have won awards. And I truthfully, and I've talked with Hillary about this, if you're not citing that dissertation, I have problems with you, especially as it relates to the issues relating to Black women's pension fights, demands for citizenship inclusion, and the realities and aftermath of military service on Black families. So Megan J. McClintock.
God, that's awesome. All right, guys, I got one last question for you. It's a thing we've been building up to the entire night. It's our last thing. Is Glory a history film?
Is this a like trick question?
Is that a trick question?
No, like, no. It's a question we ask every single week, or as I've been recording every single night lately. Is Glory a history film?
I mean, yes. Yeah.
Because if it's not, then every state school that mandates they teach it needs to go look at their curriculum. Just use that alone.
Yeah, it's way more a history film than, say, The Outlaw Josie Wales, you know, if you're looking for bad Reconstruction films.
Can we actually do one on Good, Bad, the Ugly? That's a Civil War film that people don't talk about in context of the Civil War. That is a Civil War movie.
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Right, but it's a Civil War movie, and we don't talk about it anymore.
All right, we're coming back.
Almost every – all the Westerns. The Westerns are all Civil War Reconstruction films, like most of them. It's the only series of Reconstruction films out there are the Westerns.
We're bringing Megan Kate Nelson back in. Oh, yeah. It's on. All right. So we'll do it for a few podcasts more at some point in time. So Chris Barr, Hillary Green, Adam Dombey, Holly Pinheiro. Guys, thank you so much. You are my friends. I've been wanting to sit down with you and talk to you about this. I can't tell you how awesome it is to sit down. I can't explain to you how much respect I have for each of you. Just as scholars, but even more so as my friends, I am so excited to be able to share you guys with the rest of with this podcast community and the people who are listening in. Thank you guys so very much for being here tonight. I cannot thank you enough.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for inviting us.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of the Movies podcast. Thank you so much to our guests today. Thank you so much to Hillary and Chris and Adam and Holly for being here, for talking about a history that is very difficult, a film that is important, for helping us to really think about all of these kinds of things. I learned a lot. I hope you guys did too. It was amazing. Thank you, of course, to our producer, Fletcher Powell, for being there, for producing this. To produce an episode like this, when you've got five people talking over the course of 2 hours, is a lot of work. And so thank you, Fletcher, for doing that. We really wanted to do this right for you guys. And, of course, thank you most of all to you guys for continuing to listen, to share with us, for sharing your enthusiasm with me, for telling me what movies you want on, what pods you want to listen to, what scholars you want to listen to, for sharing this with your friends and continuing to share this on social media and everywhere else. So thank you all for being here and continuing to be part of the HATM story. We've got a bunch of stuff coming for you here in February and March and into spring. Stuff that I can't tell you just about yet because I don't want to ruin the surprise, but there's a lot of really cool stuff coming. So between now and then, hope you're well, and we'll see you soon. Ciao for now.